Willkommen, ladies and gentle spoons. It's Rack Addicts After Hours time again. Episode
71.
71.
Is that?
I think
71 in German.
GCSEs were a long time ago, but I think it is. And return, possibly half a year later, to a little car park. So there's somebody compensating with a loud engine you might be able to hear in the background there. And I'm joined by our noble colleagues. We have Pete. We have Luke. In physicality, we have met. And it's wonderful.
Well, I described last week as semi-normality.
Mm, yes, and it was a smashing episode. Suddenly there was news everywhere. There was stuff to talk about. It got nerdy. It was very exciting. And then suddenly, nothing happened. So here we are. We're gonna make some stuff out of it. But what have you gentle chaps been doing this week? Luke,
hello.
Take us away, if you may.
Hi. Okay. I haven't had a huge amount going on this week. Despite enjoying the bank holiday, there was some fine-ish weather. There was some not fine weather. The winds howling at 50 miles an hour yesterday.
Indeed.
Taking away the garden furniture. That was fun. Other than that,
Did you fly away on a parasol?
No, I had to pack up all the parasols, though, because... And interestingly, I had to put some, I don't know what you call them, dumbbell weights, barbells, bells?
I think in the gym they're plates.
Plates. I had to put some plates that I had lying around, because I don't use them for lifting weights, it must be said, on all the garden furniture, because it was starting to take off. So that was fun. Otherwise, I have been buying whiskey, basically.
Ooh, what's hitting the shelves in a Luke's cabinet near us?
Well, the most exciting I've definitely had recently, and I say this because I've recently opened it and I'm enjoying it very much, is independent bottling from AD Rattray, which is an independent bottler. They also sell other companies on their web store. Nice company. They send out free samples whenever you order from them as well. Anything from their little cask collection that they do. So definitely recommend them.
What's an independent bottler when it's at home?
So with whiskey, 9 times out of 10, the distiller that makes the whiskey will bottle it and sell it themselves. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they'll have casks that they sell to other companies, such as independent bottlers. And those companies will go around to various warehouses and say, hi, we'd really like to buy this barrel, and put our nice big label on it. And for some whiskey companies, it can help them shift stuff that they otherwise wouldn't sell. And you get some really cool, rare stuff coming out of that as well. For instance, this one is I've never heard of this distillery before, but it's Tam na Vuolin. And it's a 10-year-old cask strength. It was definitely, if you're into that sort of thing, I would recommend picking it up. It was sub £50. It clocks in at 54.2% ABV, which means it's completely naturally allowed to come to that ABV. There's no watering down. It tastes, like it says on the tin, it has tasting notes on the side, and they say poached pear and vanilla. It's absolutely lovely.
Interesting. Would a bottler potentially also age in some of their own casks and take a whiskey further? Or would they just bottle it and sell it?
Depends. It does sometimes happen. You have companies like, you might have seen Signatory around. They're quite a famous one. They're quite a well-known.
No, my brain's just gone straight to Suntory, but that's Japan.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they've probably got a hold of some Suntory barrels here and there. But yeah, Signatory is one of the more widely known independent bottlers, and they will sometimes age things further. But truth be told, I'm not 100% sure on that. I'm sure it does happen, though.
Well, going back to the poached pear, was that really quite an obvious flavour? You got that note.
With tasting notes, I often wonder, is it completely psychosomatic, you know? Is it like placebo? Like you know, it says poached pear, so you go, oh, of course, I can taste pear. But I don't know. I definitely tasted it, and it definitely had this lovely, rich kind of vanilla caramel thing going on at the end. So I enjoyed it, but it's my favourite kind of whiskey. It's a sherry bomb. So anything with huge amounts of aging and sherry butts is my favourite thing.
Sounds good. With the tasting notes thing, I don't think I've ever agreed with the tasting notes. I've never found the right ones. But I think my palate is getting a little bit better. So in the coffee world, I can normally identify a flavour that I'm experiencing. It might not line up with the tasting notes, but I'm pleased that I think I can differentiate something that's not,
oh, it's just a bit of coffee. Yeah, it's a bit bitter. I think I'll go a bit coarser on the grind.
Maybe that's just me getting slightly better at making coffee. I don't really know.
I know what you mean. I often think tasting notes are overblown. They can be, the only time I've ever really seen them before and agreed with them was a rum that I had where it said like cloves and apricot, and I was like, yeah, okay, it tastes like apricot jam, but fiery. And I was like, yeah, I got that, but otherwise, yeah, I don't think my palate is refined enough, and I am an ex/current/recovering smoker, so there's that.
Did I ever read you the blurb on the front of Kalila?
No, but I imagine it's excellent.
It's amazing. It's my favourite thing. I get out all the time when we start waffling about tasting notes and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, go on.
This is a 12-year-old whiskey. It's quite nice. It might not be as smooth as some. It's a peated Isla style something. Not style. It is from Isla. Anyway, fresh, sweetly fruity and smooth-bodied. Okay, that's fair enough. That makes sense. Kalila 12-year-old is as rounded and clear as the shapes of the still room. Glimpsed by hazy shafts of sunlight glancing through the morning cloud. I can taste it.
Amazing.
I love it. It's brilliant. It's just stupid.
It's purple prose.
It's wonderful. Wonderful. Anything other than whiskey on your weekly agenda?
Oh, not particularly. Just I was doing some housework, filling holes, making new ones with a drill, and then filling those in again and so on. Bank holiday stuff.
Catching up on the slightly more fun chores, maybe. Well, Pete, what about you?
Well, I've managed to actually remove myself from that bubble app that I talked about last week.
Oh, you've cut that one off.
Well, only just long enough to put an order in for, and I've actually jumped in to a product that I was talking about a few months ago. So I have ordered today one of the Conductive Labs NDLRs.
Ah, you went for the Noodler.
Yes, I did. I noticed that was a UK retailer. In fact, it was Juno Records in London.
Yeah.
Had them in stock, and it was a lot better proposition in respect to either having one shipped from the US or from Hong Kong, which were the two previous options, or trying to grab a second-hand one if one popped up on eBay or wherever
Excellent.
Else. So that should be with me, in theory, tomorrow morning.
Well, I'll expect an essay on my desk Monday morning, sir.
Fair enough. it'd be interesting. I've watched just about every video there is on YouTube, and some are not too bad. A lot of them aren't that exciting. But I think that I'm going to manage to get a lot of nondescript ambient.
I like nondescript ambient.
So I was thinking maybe I'm going to do some of these really ultra-long records, you know, put them on YouTube for people to sleep with. Type of thing, the 10-hour recordings.
Leverage some weather samples in there.
Yeah, I was just going to sort of connect them to a selection of keyboards and just let it go and see what it can do.
Yeah, so what would be on your the top of your list for that kind of music, if you're picking from your quite large selection?
The DeepMind, because that can be really ambient. And then maybe the Summit. I was thinking of actually putting the Summit through the night sky, the Strymon night sky.
It's a pairing.
To see how that behaves. And maybe some OB6.
What a selection.
And I'm not really sure what else. Maybe something a bit more unique. Maybe the Arp Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
The sort of throbbing bass lines type thing.
I quite like it for the higher atmospheric, or the little blippy blip type bits.
Yeah, that most probably would go well through some sort of stereo delay. So that's what I shall be doing tomorrow once the item arrives.
And Excellent.
I'm relatively confident it's going to come at decent time. I'm not going to be waiting all day, sort of with my nose pressed against the window waiting for the delivery driver. The particular courier company that it's coming via is regularly at my place before 10 a.m.
Oh, perfect. Do you know your driver?
Well, I did, and I think I've seen him recently. I mean, everything's been a bit strange, as everyone the planet knows, for the last 14 months. So, but I do think I have seen him a couple of times this year. But previously, when I had a lot more deliveries, he'd sort of know me by name. I'm terrible at people's names.
I've been so bad with that. I know all of them now.
Really?
All of the guys. The Hermes guy keeps giving me a side eye. He's like, another ASOS parcel? I'm like, yeah, blood, sorry. There's Shaq, who does DPD for me. Big Shaq, he's amazing. He delivered my PC. He's wonderful.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, we're all living via courier now nowadays. I mean, I found quite a few years ago it was very hard to get exactly what you wanted anyway. If you went to the normal local retail outlets, invariably you'd come away without anything, with nothing to show for it, because the sort of things that I tend to want all seem to be special orders of some description or other.
Definitely, although it can be dangerous as well, the browsing danger. Though there are a few shops that I think that have the same effect that potentially music shops might for some people, where you kind of feel guilty when you don't walk out with something. Is it just music shops? And it doesn't happen to me anymore because I've worked in one for 3 years and I hate it. But does that Anybody else connect with that? That weird guilt at leaving empty-handed?
I would only go there if I was intending to come away with something, and I would have clarified that I actually had it in stock previous to that. But, I mean, I have to say, for the last few years, I would say good 80, possibly 90% of all my acquisitions in the respect of musical and camera equipment have all been...
Just online.
Mail order. Especially the camera equipment, because... Typically, the sort of stuff that I've used, you just can't walk into a shop and buy it.
Yeah, unless you're lucky enough to live near. I've totally forgotten this.
Well, also, you pay
one huge shop that I can't remember the name of.
You also tend to pay full retail.
Oh, yeah.
And can always get these sort of type of things, especially things like lenses and so forth, substantially cheaper via mail order.
Indeed. I have something to level at you, Pete.
Go on.
Had a conversation with one of our colleagues while doing some videos the other day. He said that going to NAMM cured his gas. And of course, we're not talking gastro anything. We're talking gear acquisition syndrome once more. But yes, he was cured of the of the affliction because of the environment around gear at that show.
In what respect? What was the mechanism that produced the cure?
I think it was a little bit of pity at the kind of people that were there and experiencing it and worshipping the product.
Mm-hmm.
He also mentioned that he noticed, obviously there's attendees and lots of famous people will be there, and the regular punters of businesses will go up to the really obvious famous people, oh, Andrew Huang, oh, amazing, and then they'll totally miss one incredible keyboard player from a band. They're like, oh wait, what they actually care about is the thing, not the experience attached to it. Kind of resonated with me a little bit when I think about my experience with Modular, which has been definitely fueled by gas and selling other things and just really fast acquisition. And then I realize, actually, one of the main things, the majority of what I really enjoyed about having Modular was actually the people that I met through it and the little jams I had with people like our friend Nick and teaching people at the ModCaf. What do you reckon, lads?
I can certainly see that. I did hear a relatively or very successful producer recently stating that, in fact, it was another, there seems to be a lot of people purging. I mean, we had Junkie XL.
Oh, yeah, big old reverb.
Having a big sell-up of everything. And I don't know, he's also relocated his studio. Mm-hmm. I have to say, his current studio still got quite a lot of equipment, but he certainly had a massive clean out. And it seems to be quite a thing, this sort of going minimalist.
Mm.
But I heard this producer state that he felt that acquisition of hardware doesn't aid professional production in any particular way, and it can be considered as potentially maybe a hobby, but not a profession. Whereas the production is potentially a profession.
Yeah.
And he was disseminating between the two different elements of producing and hoarding great amounts of equipment. I can totally see that. But having said that, the manufacturers and also retailers, such as the one we work at, rely on gas. I would imagine it's most important, because why does anyone need more than maybe one or two guitars or one or two synths or whatever their particular poison is?
You heard it here first. Music retailers are natural gas powered.
It's obvious, isn't it? I mean,
totally.
That you're completely set up to sell as much equipment as possible, and you're reliant on the people who... And we know we've got many customers who have a particular penchant for a certain manufacturer, and they have to have everything that manufacturer produces.
Yeah, definitely.
And they certainly... I mean, a lot of the people I speak to aren't actually producing anything. It's just for their own... private pleasure. They don't even go out to anything like the ModCaf or have any other sort of groups or associations they get involved with. They don't produce anything, they don't record anything, they just acquire the equipment and enjoy it for its own sake.
I think it is great as long as you do have that private enjoyment of it, as long as you have the gear and it is still fun for you rather than just buying it because.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of buying it because. I mean, I have my moments quite regularly thinking, why have I done this? What have I got all this stuff for? But I've said many times, there's plenty of more wasteful things I could have spent my money on.
Oh, yeah.
And at the end of the day, if all things don't go well, I can always sell it and recoup most of the funds that I've laid out. In fact, in some respects, more so, because quite a few, if you choose wisely, it either holds its value or maybe increases if you've chosen very wisely.
Hopefully. Luke, what about from the sort of drum corner?
I was thinking about this as you were talking, and something quite snide came across my mind. But
fire it at us.
I think I'll say it anyway. I've certainly noticed in my time working with you guys and just in the small gig scene that I've been able to enjoy and take part of, the best players have the worst gear.
Oh, yeah.
And the least amount of gear as well. I've definitely noticed that among drummers. In fact, there's a friend of mine who's a tremendous player, probably the best I know personally, and he takes his awful drum kit to gigs in cardboard boxes instead of drum cases.
Yeah.
And he knows who that is. But so shout out to that guy. He's awesome. But I don't know. It's a weird one. I think, like you were saying, Pete, I think it's nice if you can hold on to good stuff. And it's worth having in its own way. There are certainly more wasteful ways to go about. I mean, just this year, I've definitely eaten a lot of paychecks. So, you know, to buy something worthwhile that's beautiful, it's made by a good craftsman or craftsperson of any sort, is definitely worth having, I think. It's one way to spend money rather than, you know, like you say, doing something wasteful. And you never know. If you look after it, you might be able to sell it later on.
Yeah, I've no doubts that I could sell everything I've got, and I would say I would recoup maybe even 90% of what I've actually spent. I mean, with a bit of effort, I could most probably recoup 100%, to be really honest. But certainly a substantial amount. So it's all there to be gleaned back, if that was something I sort of wished to do. But I'm not sure what would happen then if I suddenly got rid of it all. It'd be, what now?
Well, you'd be at the point I'm at where I'm eyeing up cases again. The never-ending cycle.
You're in a different position in life, aren't you? You're sort
I
of
suppose,
thinking
yeah.
about other more important things like possibly house purchases and that type of thing.
Ooh, and the very good news I got today, seemingly we've done the impossible. We've got permission from the property management to have a cat.
Yay!
Whoa! I didn't think they'd say yes, but there we go.
But is it going to improve your broadband? I think not.
Absolutely not. It's not going to, no.
I have a niche theory. It may do, because Ooh. You'll be using it less. You'll be spending more time with the cat than on the internet.
Mm.
But you're still intending to move in August.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe
okay.
not. If we have to do a remote podcast, it sounds and works better from the office anyway, and we prefer doing this. So,
fair enough.
In that respect, it doesn't bother me.
I'm going on the assumption that eventually, or relatively shortly, hopefully, the social distancing side of things will abate and we'll be allowed to congregate in a more natural environment.
When that happens, you'll hear the...
Well, I'm not just thinking of outside. I'm thinking about actually, you know, to have everyone round into my studio environment. Mm. We all sit down in a proper, not I wouldn't say soundproof, but a conditioned environment.
Yeah.
And use in a situation where I'm not fretting about audio quality and technical issues and other things like getting egged or
fire engines.
loud motorcycles roaring past.
Having to bump start my car at the end of last podcast.
Yeah, that type of thing.
We maybe reach that point where the gear disappears and it becomes what it was always intended to be, the convivial post-work chat. That was the idea, wasn't it?
And in the pub after work, that type of thing. But going back to the equipment, I could certainly vouch that I was much more productive with far less equipment.
Yeah.
Substantially less equipment. And in fact, I was having a good session as it was bank holiday in the UK yesterday, and I didn't have anything else to do, so I spent most of the day in the studio working on projects and moving between pieces of equipment. It was, I wouldn't say befuddling, but I did have to focus, going, right, I'm going to stick to what I'm doing at the moment, not sort of suddenly have my mind wander to something else and then to something else and flit round the room like a butterfly, not really sort of getting anything achieved. So, and I have considered maybe pairing things down, but it's difficult to know what I would actually get rid of. Everything I currently have at the moment, or most of, I would say 99% of everything I currently have at the moment, has been carefully chosen.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of items that I'm intending to dispose of, but it really is only to allow me to dissipate the buyer's remorse when I order my next synth, which I'm likely to do before the end of this week.
Matriarch flavoured?
Most probably the Polybrute, to be really honest.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
they
no
seem
complaints
to be
there.
I was going to hold off because I thought the Polybrutes weren't available, and then I realised they are.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I will get a Matriarch, but they're not going anywhere at the moment.
Yeah, I doubt it.
So I'd really like to get my hands on a Polybrute. I've listened to a lot of demos, and people are, I wouldn't say they're hysterical, but there is a tremendous amount of excitement over that product.
Rightly so, I think.
And the Matrix Brut was on my shopping list,
mm-hmm.
and immediately fell off the shopping list as soon as the Poly Brut was announced, because that's perfection.
Oh, really. It wasn't when you threw your back out trying to move one in the shop.
Well, that deters me somewhat. Well, once I get one in my studio, it's it'll not going to be moved. Won't it? No, but they are ridiculously heavy. Mm. But I would say, after you and I having to manhandle the Moog One, which I think it officially is the heaviest synth.
Oh, it's
in the
got
world.
To be. Yeah, in and out of that box, it has to be two people. Nightmare.
Unless, well, I suppose there are other things. You know, the ARP 2500, which I've never seen one.
Oh, the vintage giant modular boy.
And then is it Studio Electronics? No, it's the other lot. It's
no, it is Studio. Wait, the Colossus. Anyway,
yeah,
that
yeah.
one.
That one's got to weigh a fair bit.
Definitely.
I see that Christian Henson from Spitfire Audio has just taken delivery of one.
Oh, really? I might have to... Is he video?
Yeah, he did a video because he was answering the Andrew Wang, is this the most beautiful synth in the world, when Andrew got
right.
his complete make noise system a couple of months ago. And his retort was that he had the Colossal. I think he called it Dave.
It has to have a silly name.
And he was setting up some patches and describing how to use the pin matrix and so forth. Yeah. But it was early days. But yeah, he was thinking, because it has eight oscillators, doesn't it?
More. 12 to 16? I can't quite remember. But they are 12? Only 3340s. They're not very exciting. That was one of your complaints when we first spoke about it, I think.
Yeah, because I don't think the original uses those chips.
Likely not. And it's not a clone, really. It's more inspired by the idea of
the big console thing. Yes, it's got the superficial look of that system. Isn't it the EMS, their large a copy of... Or
very good
a
question.
Tribute to that.
I don't know.
But anyway, it's one of the... Yes, so I did have a look. I think the deposit's 7,000, the deposit.
What are they, 30, 40 full beans?
I don't know. It doesn't say. It's one of those if you
price
can't...
Price on request.
Yes, exactly. If you
have
know,
to ask.
If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Yeah, one of those. Right. It is May the 4th as we record. Luke, you said that you might have a bit of some beef to get off your chest right now. I've got the steak knives over here, but deliver it for us. What's happening in the Star Wars world that's annoyed you today?
Just the whole thing, really. Just not a fan.
Is there a recent development?
There
or something that reminded you of your deep hatred? Potentially.
Just, I mean, the abundant amount of better quality storytelling that's out there that doesn't get anywhere near the budget that Star Wars gets to make a fantastic live-action film with beautiful CG. The fact that they change the rules every time they start a film on how anything in-universe works. The fact that the Rebellion doesn't represent the equal rights of droids. I mean, goodness.
That's not what I expected, the equal rights bit.
It's amazing. Like, so, if you've seen Solo...
Yes.
No, I haven't, but okay. I'm probably not going to watch it.
Do you mind if I spoil it for you?
Just go for it. Listeners...
It's a point, actually.
Spoiler warning for... What's it called? Something Han, Star Wars-y?
Han Solo, a Star Wars... No, Solo, a Star Wars story? Is that what it's called?
That's how forgettable it was for Luke. Anyway, plow through, spoilers ahead.
I should preface, Star Wars was dear to my heart as a kid. You know, I watched episode 4, 5 and 6 on VHS.
Ooh,
before
yes.
they were remastered, and loved it. As an adult, I enjoyed episode 1, 2 and 3 more than I did when they aired in the cinema in the 2000s.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't hate it, but there are so many problems with it. And I'll start with the Rebellion thing and the rights of robots in the Star Wars universe. So they quite clearly are sentient, right?
Yeah.
They have feelings, emotions, memories, and it's clear that the Empire embodies some sort of evil overlord type thing. They just want to crush and assimilate all life and whatever, and it does their bidding, and there's no dissent and disorder and all that. But the Rebellion is not much better when it comes to droids. I mean, C-3PO's memory is wiped all the time because they don't like him. They don't care about him. He's annoying. He's inconvenient as a character. He's too much of a loose mouth, so they're just there, we'll just reset him. There's the droid prison in Return of the Jedi, where they torture and pull apart all the droids for misbehaving or failing in their tasks.
Oh, I remember that bit. Yeah.
And you just kind of think, well, why wouldn't the Rebellion kind of take issue with some stuff like this? And then in the Solo story, there is the fate of, and this is where the spoilers kick in, L337, which, if you're a nerd, spells Leet. So that's a robot that leads a revolt in the film. She unplugs the restraining harnesses of all these robots at a certain point in the film, and she's punished by being murdered and assimilated into the Millennium Falcon's flight computer for an eternity of servitude as punishment for her uprising.
Right.
It's just like, come on. I don't know. So these are very small, niche, nerdy complaints. But just the new films, I don't know if you've enjoyed them. I thought the pacing was a bit strange. I thought particularly the last film, number 9, that could have been 2 films.
What happened in it? I've forgotten already.
Well, exactly. So much stuff. In the second of the new films, which is now 8, I think, which is called The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
A good chunk of that film didn't need to happen. It was just really odd. This is very much from an artistic critique, story writing type thing. It's like, it was a very odd film. And then episode 9 was enormously long, had loads of stuff in it, but none of it was fleshed out. There were just these glimpses of stuff where this very interesting and intricate universe. It's like, it's a bit of a written by committee disaster. You've got lots of really good ideas and some beautiful CG and decent acting and so on. Some not decent acting as well. But if it had been given more room to breathe, it would have been a good film, I think. And I think considering how bad The Last Jedi was, if they just got rid of that film and made the new one, episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, there you go, that's what it's called. If they made that into 2 films, I think you'd have a much better trilogy than what they have now.
Well, the middle one was not J.J. Abrams directing. He did episode 7, I want to say, and episode 9. But he left episode 8, the one that you found most objectionable, to a different director. And then he was recalled. Have you watched any of The Mandalorian, or have you had the help?
I do. I have, yes. And I do like The Mandalorian.
And you're okay with that one. And have you got any expectations for the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, which is heading our way?
Well, it's Star Wars, so I have no expectations whatsoever, no.
Fair enough.
But I do hope it's good.
But, I mean, the general thing is it's designed for such a broad age range or age demographic that it almost denotes that it's going to be somewhat bland, because it's got to be it's got to be palatable, it's got to be child friendly.
They've probably got to chuck in some throwaway humour to keep people with no attention span engaged.
I'm fine with that, but particularly with 8 and 9, The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker, they packed a lot of absolute rubbish into very, very small amounts of time. So there were sections in that scene where the dialogue was quick fire. There's no mood to it. And I want them to take a leaf from people like Villeneuve or whoever and just slow the pace down a bit. It's supposed to be an epic space opera. I know, the whole point of this franchise is to sell toys to kids. It always has been that since the 70s. But pacing has just gone from them, I think.
Don't you find that? Well, a lot of
modern
movies which are designed to capture the widest audience as possible.
Mm, I suppose maybe I'm just being grumpy.
And the real classics, which are very focused, have a cerebral kind of plot, you know, the sort of films that leave you thinking about them for weeks afterwards, you know. They don't have a broad appeal, do they?
Well, take the new Blade Runner. I think that kind of got panned critically. Not panned, but it wasn't, I don't think it did as well as they wanted it to, but it's aged quite well critically. It's been kind of redeemed, I think, in a way. I'm making that up.
It's an extraordinarily beautiful film.
And it's about the same runtime as the latest Star Wars film, but there's about half the amount of dialogue, if not a third, and it works better for it.
Well, I think there's a lot of story via picture rather than dialogue, so to speak.
I think that's it. I think that's what I'm getting at. And again, I think this is just me being a grumpy artiste, but I'm a massive fan of Show Me, Don't Tell Me.
Yeah.
And I think that respects the audience's intelligence a bit more. Because also, it's fun. If you sit there and you're staring at a film, you're going, what on earth is that about? It's so much more engaging than like, hold on, I've just had all the exposition given to me in one conversation with 2 people that I don't understand what their relationship to each other is, but they want me to buy the toys. So hang on, wait, what happened there? I'll just slow down. That was the thing with the Rise of Skywalker. So much happened in like very short spaces of time. I was like, what on earth is going on?
That was something that I really enjoyed about the series Dark. Either of you caught on that one?
I'm aware of it, but it's a foreign language series, isn't it? On
Netflix. Yeah, it's German. I watched it in German, because I'm kind of used to reading subtitles at this point. But I really appreciated, I think it was really carefully paced, in terms of how they were delivering information to you. Spoiler free on this one, because I think everybody should go and watch it. But the interpersonal networks and family relationships of this small German town are really important to the plot. And I have a terrible memory anyway, but a lot of it is quite show me, don't tell me, to borrow your phrase there, Luke. There'll be...
Oh, it's not mine.
Well, it is now, because I don't know where else it could have come from. Anyway, they'll be in a family home. And of course, in an establishing shot, they're going to sweep over bedside table with pictures. There'll be a kid's bedroom with posters and little family photos pinned up. So you recognize the faces. It gives you context for the inside of the homes, all of which are really, really important. And it keeps coming back to them all the time.
Yeah.
So over the first series, you've actually, a rough guess, there's going to be 50-odd characters that you actually know quite well. And you know who's related to who and who's cheating on who. That kind of stuff. I really enjoyed how they did that. I think it falls down in other places, but that was something I knew I would definitely struggle with. As an audience member, if it wasn't handled so carefully.
Has it got a supernatural element, like a Stranger Things type thing going on?
Yeah, it's slightly sci-fi, quite mystery, but less of the fantasy-ish, technology-ish, aliens-y
bit.
It's a bit more of the science of the fi.
And the interpersonal relationships, the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And they're not, nothing feels too gratuitous in the, ooh, fancy visual effect. I really think everybody should go and watch Dark. I still haven't finished the third season, but the first two were absolutely brilliant.
Nice. Yeah, I'll pick that up.
That could be my miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. And it is that time. You know what that means, audience memberinos. It's time for Luke's Spacey Bit. I blame you for being here. That's when I forget. So what I've done there, Pete, is you now can't really edit out my terrible memory. So I've scuppered myself. Luke, take it away.
So we have, in the spirit of trying to lose a bit of lockdown weight, I thought I'd do a sort of diet or digest bulletin, because a lot has happened over the last week. Mm. A lot has happened. I mean, a lot is happening all the time. Space is very big, and there are a lot of countries on this planet that are interested in putting things up in that space. But in a weird twist of events, I've not had a huge amount of time to do a deep dive on anything, but at the same time, it's quite fortuitous because lots has been going on. To tackle one story briefly, there's a lot of pandemonium in the news about China's Long March 5B rocket raining down from the heavens and blowing up everything. Part of this comes from, I think, just a general sense of unease about China's space program, because it's not something... And NASA has their secrets, ESA don't necessarily publish everything, sure, but it's a very different political landscape in terms of how space program is treated. It's very much a national pride thing for China, and it is to some extent for America, but it's a civilian agency. It's very much in the hands of, you know, it's quite easy to get information from and about NASA. But to cut a long story short, is that China launched the core element of their new space station, and they launched it on a Long March 5 rocket, which is a huge heavy lift vehicle, a new one that they've put up, and part of that has come back down in an uncontrolled re-entry burn. And a lot of fuss in the news has been made about how perhaps that is slightly too large of a rocket to leave in an uncontrolled re-entry, and parts of it may land in inhabited areas. Now, experts have said that's probably very unlikely, although last time they did this, some debris was spotted on the Ivory Coast, which was obviously not ideal because there are people living there. But for the most part, this should come and crash down in the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean by the time it's finished its orbit, and majority of the junk has burnt up in orbit. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's like, it would be nice to see if there was some more responsible decisions being taken about where specifically large chunks of debris are going to land. But at the same time, I do think a lot of the terror in the news is overblown. So yeah, the Long March 5B is not coming to a house near you soon, but at the same time, it is probably the part that they jettisoned that has been left to come back down in an uncontrolled manner is possibly too big. And this is just not to say that other space agencies don't do the same thing. I mean, the SLS is pretty much going to just ditch in the ocean after it's got halfway up, and that thing is enormous. Space debris is a thing that happens, and the re-entry, the uncontrolled re-entry burn of stuff that comes back down is something that only really SpaceX is avoiding, and companies like them, like Blue Origin, where they're building reusable rockets. But at the same time, yeah, maybe some more detail published to other parts of the world would be nice next time they do this sort of thing. But that's that. future listeners will be aware of the results of the new Starship test, which is going to happen potentially tonight. It's the SN15 launch, so that's serial number 15. It's the latest and greatest Starship prototype that they've built. Hopefully this one will land on its feet and not on its side and not in a ball of fire.
15 being it's the 15th that they've had to build because they've blown up or broken or fallen over spectacularly.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that's quite a few.
This one's got some new and interesting Gen 2 or new and improved Raptor engines. That's the name of the engine they use, the Raptor. So the nice thing about this rocket is they haven't had to reinstall new engines after the grounded fire test. So that's a good sign. The engines are more reliable by the sounds of it. So they are probably going to, hopefully, get some good results with this one. But we shall see, because Starship is enormous. It's 50 meters tall, 9 meters wide. It's a crazy, crazy thing. And no one's ever done anything quite like this. So if they land it, that'll be a first. And that will be exciting
to
see.
Didn't they land the last one, but then it blew up a sort of 5 minutes later?
Yeah, so we don't really count that one.
Okay, fair enough.
Technically, they did it.
It did land, though.
It landed too hard. One of the legs broke, and it caused the header tank to rupture inside. And it went pop. I think there were other issues at play there as well, but certainly one of the main things was that they couldn't thrust up fast enough. One of the engines still wasn't working properly, and as a result, yeah, it hit the ground slightly too hard. I might do a deep dive on this in the future, because there is a lot of people saying, like, well, why are they doing this in the first place? Why drop it like a stone from a certain height and then fire the engine at the last minute? And there's some interesting detail about why they're doing this for the shape of the rocket they've got. So I might do a proper segment on that in the future. So watch this space.
But they'll get there eventually, I mean, with persistence. I mean, you know, things have improved on every flight.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something where we're only going to see continuous improvement, I think. And obviously the speed with which they're building these things is incredible. I mean, how long has it taken NASA to get one SLS ready to fire? And this is the 15th Starship ready to fly. I mean, granted, it's
not... They are moving
not,
pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, granted, this is not a fully crewed module thing. This is very much a prototype, but it's, you know... They've done a lot in a very short amount of time. So briefly, going back to the Red Planet, because we've been dwelling on that quite a lot. Ingenuity, the Mars helicopter, has flown so well that NASA's extended its planned mission window by an extra 30 Martian days. They say they plan to use the craft and the scouting capacity for that 30-day timeline, but it's not a hard limit. Amongst other things, sorry, I should say they're going to continue the test flights they've been doing, but at a slower pace. So rather than one every 2 or 3 days, it will go down to approximately one or every 2 or 3 weeks. But it depends on how the hardware fares. And to be honest, it may even outlast that new 30 days. They say it's very much not a hard limit. They'll continue to monitor how the hardware performs, and perhaps it will last even longer in the fashion of how, like, Opportunity, a rover designed for 2 years, lasted 10 or 12 or something like that. And obviously the Voyagers are still going nearly 50 years on from when they were launched. And so it could be one of those little things where it was designed to sort of do 10 test flights and it may well last for years. But we shall watch the space on that one. There's been some new images sent back where you can actually see Perseverance from the helicopter, from Ingenuity.
Nice one. Has it been doing some horizontal stuff now then?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, the fourth flight was the longest and most complex. It flew a bit higher than previously we stated on the podcast, and actually across and travelled, translated, which is really cool.
Excellent.
And finally, this one's a bit more... I felt bad, because when we first started doing this, we were doing a lot of astronomy stuff, and I've been doing a lot of space flight for a while, a lot of actual hardware news and so on.
Well, if there's no hardware news in the synth world, you've obviously got to compensate for us.
Well, exactly, but astronomy, I think, to me, is somewhat more fascinating, and certainly there's some interesting stuff going on, but it requires a lot more understanding to actually present it properly to our listeners. But this one's a quick one, a quick win that is just really exciting. Astronomers have managed to directly image a gas giant in formation, which is just something really crazy. A lot of the images you'll see of space, of nebula, of anything, they're usually post-processed, I should say, or they're an artist render, and often that won't actually be anywhere like on there unless you can see a little copyright NASA images on the bottom right. And even then, if those are the images you're looking at, they're probably all from Hubble, which is just incredible. One telescope has given us so many images. So images taken of the PDS-70 system, a star in the Centaurus constellation, which I've never heard of, but it's a southern sky constellation, approximately 370 light years away, show a very young PDS-70b, which is about the size of 5 Jupiters. It's a gas giant, and it's in its sort of protoplanetary nursery. There's a disk of gas and stuff orbiting around this planet and its sun. They think it's going to continue to coalesce, and the planet will grow by about 1/100th of itself, a bit more. So it's already massive, but it apparently is going to be essentially all that there is in that system, as far as we can tell at the moment anyway. The team was led by Dr. Yifan Zhou. They imaged the planet's ultraviolet radiation and screened out noise from the star nearby using new post-processing techniques that they haven't had available.
Not something you'll find on Photoshop, I imagine.
No. Well, then again, I don't know, this is probably all very much algorithmical stuff, like how they compiled that huge code to build the image of the black hole.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of years ago. So this, of course, is only a snapshot in time. The hope is that Hubble will be able to take images of the planet periodically in the future to track the progress and to confirm the observation. You know, we also hope that with tools like the James Webb Space Telescope going live in the near future, that observations of this kind will become much more commonplace, because, you know, it's one thing. So, like, we know of about 2,000 plus exoplanets. They've been taken by images like TESS, which is the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and Kepler as well, things like Kepler, where they'll look at stars and they'll look for like wobbles and stuff, or they'll look for like changes in certain radio frequencies, or like or just any sort of wavelength, and we can infer, oh, there's probably a planet orbiting around that. And the scientists can tell a lot of stuff from very minimal data on this stuff. But to have an actual direct image is a very special thing in comparison. So there's only about 15 planets that have been directly imaged that are outside of the solar system. So this is just one more to add to that. And hopefully we'll see a bit more of that as new tools keep coming online. Just, again, Hubble is just fantastic. It's given us so much stuff.
Nice one. Do you happen to have a sort of range, probably not the right word, approximate range that we can appreciate that the Hubble can kind of get to? Because I know different imaging techniques will have, they can, you know, show us things certain distances away. Where does Hubble top out?
Oh, in terms of how far it can see?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know the exact figure off the top of my head, but we mentioned the Hubble Deep Field on a podcast ages ago where they pointed at a black square of the night sky for...
So the space equivalent of a long exposure.
Yeah, and like a really tiny dot the size of a fingernail in terms of what the telescope could see at minimum zoomification. And once, after they left it there for 10 days, it saw galaxies that were hundreds of millions of light years away and so on. So I don't know exactly. I think it can see back to... I know the reason why they want the James Webb Space Telescope online for one reason is because it can see back, if you like, in time and therefore distance much further than... Well, it is much further in real terms, but if you look at like the percentage of the... Cause the universe is, what, 13.7, 14 billion years old, something like that? And I think Hubble can see very far into that, but James Webb will be able to go just that step further to look at some of the earliest seconds of the universe.
Cool. Isn't James Webb a infrared telescope? So it's going to see the longer wavelengths that would be the further stars and galaxies, so to speak.
Yeah, it will do better at helping us pick out like redshift away from things, so we can see where stuff is. Either is it actually old or is it just moving fast? They can compensate for that, I think, at the moment, but things like James Webb will be able to clear up a lot of stuff like that.
I have been waiting a very long time for that telescope to launch. I've been following it for at least 15 years on and off, and it's been delayed quite a few times as well.
I think the current rumour is October this year.
That would be something.
Yeah, I think that'll be on an Ariane of some sort. But yeah, fingers crossed that'll happen.
Well, they need to. I mean, I think it was originally... Is it 2015 it was supposed to go up initially, or was it 2018? I can't remember. It's substantially behind.
It's very over budget as well. It's one of those things where, maybe some more haste and less private companies would be good.
Trouble is the nature of it. I mean, at least Hubble was repairable when they made the mistake with the polishing of the primary lens.
Yes.
But, or the primary mirror, I should say. But this is going to go out to... It's one of these Lagrange points, isn't it? So it's going to be totally beyond reach if it needs repairing, so it has to work first time.
Yeah, it'll be stuck there. And they've spent a lot of... Obviously, that design is designed to compensate for that. And I think if you listen back to one of our earlier episodes, we did a deep dive on the James Webb Space Telescope and how the mirrors work. It's just fascinating. You get look up some images if you can. But, yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, Hubble, you can pop out there with the space shuttle. They did many times. But, a Lagrange point is a very long way away from our high Earth orbit, so... It has to be perfect first time.
I've just got that comment you made, Luke. Seeing further is seeing further back in time.
Yes.
That's definitely a space vertigo thought. That
it is.
It's brilliant.
Space constantly gives me vertigo. I mean, yeah. If you want some vertigo right now, just look up at the sky and imagine there isn't actually an up.
Yep.
So have fun.
Yeah, we're just in the gravity well of this planet.
Yeah. Sorry, listeners.
Yeah.
I like to sometimes think that if you look straight ahead forward, you're actually looking out into space as well, because, of course, the Earth is curved.
Lovely. A trip to space. And, of course, I didn't get my timings wrong. I didn't forget anything. I know how this podcast works. I've done 70 and a half episodes now. It's time for the Miscellaneous Multimedia Recommendation, because now it has a title. After so many millions of, I don't know, anyway, rambling. I recommended Dark. It's on Netflix. Watch it in German because I say so. Although if you're eating at the same time, if you like to eat in Netflix, the subtitles can be a little tricky sometimes because you end up spilling things. So don't go for the white shirt, bolognese, and subtitled Netflix. That's a disaster waiting to happen. But what have you chaps got lined up for our listeners?
Do you want to close this out, Pete? I'll go first.
Yes, please.
So I think I've recommended this before, but I also think I haven't, so we're going to go for it. Season 4 of Castlevania is coming out on Netflix very soon. The 13th of May is the release date for that. If you haven't watched Castlevania before, I thoroughly recommend you watch the first three seasons. It's an animation, but it's very much a grown-up one. It is voice acted by a supreme cast. You've got Richard Armitage, you've got James Callis, who is Dr. Baltar from Battlestar Galactica, among many other things, a good voice actor. You've got Alejandra Reynoso, who is from Red Dead 2, many other children's TV shows and so on. You've got Graham McTavish, who played a character in The Hobbit, who I can't remember their Hobbit name, so forgive me, Lord of the Rings fans. And you've got Bill Nighy, who is a recurring character.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just a really, really good show, really gritty and gruesome vampire show based on the games of the same name. And they just kind of explore a little bit of the lore and put the story together into an actual kind of narrative, which is just really nice. So that's Castlevania on Netflix, and Season 4 returns on the 13th of May.
Nice one. I have watched Season 1, and it really didn't grab me.
Oh,
when does it start getting interesting?
I thought Season 1, personally, but...
Okay.
I put it off for a while. A friend recommended it to me. I watched like Episode 1 and was like, nah. But then after a little time, I went back and just enjoyed it much more thoroughly.
I think the only... the only thing that kept me watching through that one is the main dude whose name I instantly forgot.
Trevor?
Is potentially. What's his surname?
Belmont?
Yep, that's the chap. Yeah, because that's Thorin Oakenshield.
Yes, yeah, Richard Armitage.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's the chap who always turns up in unexpected places, because I saw him first as sort of the final love interest in The Vicar of Dibley. And then suddenly he's Thorin Oakenshield, and now he's in Castlevania. He just kind of pops up, which is very strange.
He's also the bad guy in a South Korean sci-fi called Space Sweepers, which is really good. That's also on Netflix.
Oh, that's turned up on the podcast before, Space Sweepers.
I think it might have done.
Yeah, I need to check that one out. But no, I feel I should persevere. It's at this weird halfway point where it hasn't really grabbed me,
yeah.
But it's obviously of really high quality that it's going to work if I let it.
If you want like a hype man to do some work for you, maybe watch the season 4 trailer, because that got me invested again.
Cool. Season 1 was just 4 episodes. How many are they, all 4 episodes?
No, it does long out a little bit.
Okay, cool.
The form I think stays roughly the same runtime. They might go down from, because they're quite long episodes, aren't they, if I remember right? Approaching
maybe
40 minutes, I think.
I don't think they were in the first season.
So I think the length of the season about doubles.
Right.
In 2 and 3. Cool. So I think you've got 8 to 10.
I think maybe that there just wasn't that much to chew on in the first 4 episodes.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I'll continue, because I'm on halfway through episode 1 of season 2, I think.
Well, all of these answers are on Netflix, so forgive my inaccuracies.
Castlevania. Get stuck in. Pete. It's your time. Take us away.
Right, this week I've got a YouTube channel which I struggle to describe, and I haven't really got a good point of reference for it. There's a certain amount of VR content, but it's not the normal. Most of the VR channels that I follow are basically just talking about VR news, talking about headsets, talking about games, but this is a bit more, I don't know, cerebral, possibly. I mean, the description of the channel just says, creating off-world entertainment.
Specific.
Okay. So the channel is called Disrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And there are videos entitled such thing as I Spent a Week in VR.
I might have accidentally run across that one.
24 hours spent standing up.
Oof.
It goes on along like that. Last to survive Minecraft VR island wins. So there's certainly a lot of VR, but it seems to deal with a lot of the VR lore and sort of the fringes. Like a lot of new or popular technologies, there's a certain fringe element to everything, like the sort of the dark web or something like that, possibly. But yeah, some of them some of the titles of these are a bit strange. I know I watched one, and I'm not sure what I was watching, and I will have to go back. But I think it needs some attention, and I will go back. Here's another one: a disrupting VR cult. I don't know what I mean.
Human experiences in the virtual world, potentially.
Yeah, it does seem to be like that. That sort of point. I mean, it's that point where you're getting this crossover that we're starting to get now. And I can imagine as the technology gets better, people are going to spend a lot more time. I mean, personally, I would imagine the maximum I've ever spent in VR is maybe an hour, if that.
Yeah.
And generally, it's most probably possibly about 20 minutes to half an hour, because especially some of the games that I tend to play, they're so physical. And I'm getting to an age where I haven't got the stamina that I have to sort of rest, and hopefully, well, as I say, they have save points so you can sort of save your progress and exit and grab a bit of reality. Not of the VR type. But I can imagine as this goes on and the technology gets more and more immersive, that people will, you know, start spending extended periods in there, which will be a bit strange.
You reckon, you know, there's since we're Netflixing a lot this episode, the are you still watching? Or will there be, it'll force pause your VR experience and go, eat something.
There are
your blood sugar's low.
There are already things that you can set up in that respect.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They are aware that the people are likely to spend excessive amounts of time in there, and obviously the technology vendors don't want litigation. People sort of, you know, I don't know, some new kind of psychosis induced by VR, which I would imagine is not necessarily a impossible thing to happen.
I think they're probably there, but not diagnosed yet, I imagine. I think we'll see some of that as the hardware gets more efficient as well, and you get lighter, cheaper headsets. I think you'll see like, oh, this person's starved.
Well, yeah, there've been sort of, I don't want to pin it on World of Warcraft, but there's been MMO-related deaths, haven't there, for that exact reason.
There's been quite a few science fiction type of storylines that focus on people being in some sort of virtual environment without, in fact, obviously the most famous one would be The Matrix. Exactly that. But
Ready Player One, Sword Art Online, lots of stuff.
Red Dwarf, the sci-fi comedy from the, I would like to say, the 90s, or maybe late 80s, then the 90s. And certainly in the books, there is a game called Better Than Life.
Oh, yeah.
Which the
ominous
protagonists in the story don't actually realise they're in for a time.
Oh, right.
And then they endeavour to escape it, only to be in another virtual reality. And I seem to remember a Rick and Morty episode on a similar line to that.
That's a fun one. M. Night Shyamalan's is the title of that episode.
So I would imagine that this could be a thing.
Time will tell.
I know that, here's one, another one titled, The Studio Attempting to Make the Real Oasis.
Ah, yeah, it's happening.
I mean, I did recently try to gain access to Facebook Horizons, which is their kind of version of the Oasis, which was threatened to be available this year. And initially it was...
I've just twigged, I thought you were talking about the Gallaghers. I'm so sorry.
That's right. It was only available via invitation. You could apply, and I made the mistake because it did ask, are you involved in some sort of social media or something like that? And I should have said, yes, I do a podcast. Because obviously they want
people talking about it.
Yeah, they want influences in there. So there are people engaged with the Facebook environment, but I have failed to gain access so far. But it'll be interesting to see what it's like when it becomes a thing. Yeah. I have participated in other social VR. It tends to be populated by quite young
otaku
children and or immature
VR chat
teenagers. yeah, that's the one. And there's there just seem to be people tearing around, just being silly. To be honest, I would imagine it's going to get a lot more deep and interesting at some point.
Yeah, certainly.
Anyway, so that would be my recommendation. YouTube channel Disrupt, and that's spelled D-I-S-R-U-P-T.
Lovely stuff. And that rounds us off. 71 episodes of what is, of course, your favourite podcast that you can find anywhere on the internet that you should so desire. And that will be a farewell from Pete, Luke and Ben. You stay safe. Yeah, that was it. Press the button.